Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to the Game Podcast from The Times. I'm Gregor Robertson. We're with you twice a week throughout the season for all the best reaction and analysis from some of the best football writers in the business. Joining us today are The Times chief sports writer Matt Dickinson, The Sunday Times reporter Rebecca Myers, and The Times football statistician Bill Edgar. Coming up, we'll discuss where the power lies in North London before Sunday's big derby and take a look at Alexis Sanchez's Premier League legacy. But there's only one place to start this week, and that is the tragic demise of Bury and the existential crisis facing the Football League. This week, Bury were expelled from the EFL, and Bolton Wanderers also flirted with extinction before finally being sold. How these two proud old clubs got into a mess is not a straightforward question. Matt, you've written an excellent piece in The Times today, which highlights the difficulty in protecting lower league clubs like these, because essentially there are more troubled clubs than potentially decent owners out there. That's a huge barrier to overcome, no matter what regulations change.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think, you know, I've certainly traced through a few of them, huge holes in EFL regulations, whether that's to do with the type of owners who come in or, you know, financial fair play, which obviously, if it worked, would make, you know, for a lot less loss-making clubs. But the fact is that, you know, there are, as Martin Ziegler traced a few months ago, a substantial majority of lower league clubs do lose money, and this is the sort of, I think, the crucial context against which this all has to be set. You know, I think there's a lot of emotion, understandably, wrapped up in the stories of Bolton and especially Bury being expelled. But yeah, we also have to, you know, say, understanding that, we have to look, have be sort of quite hard-headed about this broad context, which is those lower leagues are losing, you know, hundreds of millions of pounds every year. And, you know, if you want to attract, you know, well, that for a start is unlikely to attract wise and prudent people. Is going to attract either people, you know, who've got money to burn, and how many of those are out there, or, as we've seen, chances.
Yeah, I mean, it was 52 of the 72 clubs in the Football League ended 2017-18 in the red. More than 10% of clubs failed to pay their players on time at least once. 8 clubs were issued with winding up petitions, which is almost half as many as were in the previous 5 years. This is really a bigger issue than 2 clubs alone, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think this country can sustain 92 professional clubs, and in fact a few more in the
I'm glad to hear you say that, because people have been raising this question and it's kind of making my blood boil, I'll be honest.
I mean, but it ultimately comes down to how many fans are there, how many people will turn up at the weekend, what are they prepared to pay, and is that enough for a living for the players, as, you know, down to League Two and into the National League. I think, you know, it can sustain 100. Now, the problem is that you get one club that decides to spend too much, goes beyond its means, and then other clubs think, oh no, we've got to, they follow suit, because they think, well, we've got to keep up, otherwise we won't won't have any success. And then if the initial club spends beyond its means, either the gamble pays off and they have success, which is unfair on their rivals who haven't gambled, or it all explodes and they go bust, you know, as happened with Bury. So, I mean, it's tricky. We really have to have set some sort of strict spending limits or just some sort of boundaries so that clubs will have to act within their means. I mean, if it's just 100 companies all trying to sell the best baked beans or something, nobody cares who, you know, if 99 go out of business. But,
absolutely.
But, you know, football clubs, they've got to be protected, of course.
My worry, I think it is a sort of there's a fundamental fork in the road, isn't there, about sort of, you know, do we just keep tightening up rules or do we accept that, you know, they're going to be, you know, a lot of clubs that are sort of, you know, we hope are sort of competently run or close to it, and a few that will, you know, end up in a predicament. I mean, my worry about the sort of endless tightening of regulations is the ability to do it. I mean, the EFL are struggling colossally just with, you know, the regulations as they are. The leadership is really not, successive leaderships are not sort of trusted or certainly don't have a lot of credibility with the clubs. You know, we just look at the regulations as they stand and the impossibility of enforcing them. I mean, as I've highlighted just one today, this, you know, you got some of the biggest clubs, Derby County, Sheffield Wednesday, Villa, you know, this lease, you know, sell the ground to their own owners and lease it back, which is just, you know.
Yeah, there's always loopholes and everything.
Well, it's just taking the mickey out of the rules completely, yeah. Isn't it? And actually, it's dangerous. It's because, you know, the minute you divorce the ownership of a ground from the club, that potentially sets up, you know, as we've seen in quite a few cases, sets up a massive issue for the future if that owner ever decides to wash their hands of it. So, you know, you've actually got a situation where EFL rules are encouraging something that's basically pretty bonkers recklessly dangerous for clubs. So, you know, there is clearly a, you know, very good case to be made for tightening regulations, but the enforcing of it, that's a whole other story.
Well, maybe come to what a few kind of the mooted solutions are in a moment. But Rebecca, first of all, you were telling me off just before we came on that you see some parallels between the sort of financial precariousness in the Football League to the women's game.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's fascinating for me to watch, obviously, as primarily covering the women's beat. We were already seeing stuff like this start to happen in the women's game. The women's game is obviously, you know, comparatively quite young. It's undergoing a huge amount of change and there will be a lot of teething pains there. But we've seen clubs like Yeovil Town obviously went under. The Doncaster Rovers Bells have had huge financial problems, not in just resulting from, but partly to do with basically being removed from the top tier by the FA because they couldn't make these new financial requirements that were necessary. And I think it's fascinating because these are the legacy clubs. The women's game, a lot of the clubs don't have great legacies. They don't have great followings in their area yet because they're new. Manchester United, for example, has been set up essentially as a new, you know, a new offset of the men's side. But Donny Rover Bells have been going since the 60s. They've got an incredible following, incredible supporters. And they, you know, they've been taken out of the top tier. They're now playing in much, much lower leagues with real financial difficulties. They're struggling a lot with their fan base because of that. And the women's game is losing clubs that actually bring the fans. And going back to what Bill said just now, ultimately, football is about the gate. Football is about people coming to watch a game. And we've got so far from that. It's astonishing how far we've got from that. And all of these conversations about this kind of level of debt, ultimately, if you aren't getting your fans through the door to pay to watch your game, you know, you've got a big problem. You can just a quick glance through some of the lower leagues' attendance figures. There are plenty of clubs there that are going to have problems in the very near future.
Yeah. Although it's, can I just add, I was surprised. If I knew it, I'd forgotten it. That last year the EFL clubs had a 60-year high of attendances, What was it, 18.4 million? So it's, you know, I mean, that's higher since 1958-59. So, you know, I know sometimes there can be a little quirk if you have a Villa and a Sunderland or whatever, but it's a startling statistic nonetheless. And again, sort of further context to the Bury thing, that it's, you know, there is this context of a lot of clubs losing money, and say, is regulation the answer?
Well, let's look at a few of the things. You touched upon a few in your piece, Matt. Obviously, the starting point everyone talks about is the owners and directors test, which essentially at the moment means if you have an unspent conviction, if you're not disqualified as a director, you're not a criminal, then you can pass, essentially. And as we saw, Steve Dale didn't even have to provide proof of funds, which really was a catastrophic error. So that's the starting point. But there's other things have been mooted about, things like potential owners have to issue a bond which would cover any defaults in the future, a salary cap, and the most sort of out there suggestion has been an independent regulator. How likely or plausible do you feel any of these things are, Matt?
Independent regulator, yeah, my worry about that would just be, you know, really, is it going to be equipped to trawl? You know, I've read lots of pieces today, I'm not sort of just dismissing out of hand. I understand why people are airing the idea of sort of a watchdog going through all the books, but again, you know, really, are we going to, you know, is anyone going to dedicate who's paying for that? Who's going to dedicate the manpower? Who's going to pay for, you know, this police force to go to be sort of on the back of every club when the EFL is out of its depth already?
Well, it's been suggested that the FA would take over this.
Well,
certainly, so a lot of support
again,
on that.
Again, well, that's, again, probably from a lot of people who spend most of their life, you know, slagging off the FA's competence to do what, you know, the FA is already sort of, there's an argument to be said that it's got more than enough on its plate that it can handle. I mean, I think, you know, if we're talking, I mean, the one I aired is, you know, which I think is in some ways to sort of gets to the nub of the issue, is this sort of idea of a protected bond. I mean, I think, as you say, the key problem with a couple of the takeover of Bolton in 2016, I think it was, and the takeover of Bury last December, was that the new owners weren't equipped. You know, they didn't have, you know, they were, you know, taking over troubled clubs and, you know, were drowning very, very quickly themselves before they was, you know, couldn't swim to keep afloat. And now the idea of a protected bond, you know, that you have to show funds to guarantee not just the next week and the next month, but the length of, say, of players' contracts. If those are, you know, if there are 3-year contracts, you've got to sort of, you know, put that protected money there, is, you know, a sort of logical, simple answer to that. The big but comes in where we started. You know, there is a, you know, these are loss-making clubs generally. There is a lack of credible owners. I spoke to someone involved with Bolton who said that, you know, there's any number of people ringing them up saying, you know, can I have a word about buying the club? But the amount of credible ones, well, there was one that they've sold to. So if you enforce a rule like that protected bond, how many is that going to leave who are interested and stroke able to buy a loss-making business?
One other thing, Bill, I was wanting to touch on is, in the kind of reporting of this, it seemed certainly to me that in the last couple of weeks, when Bury and Bolton's peril became so clear that everyone sort of, this has become a huge issue, but this has been happening at Bury and Bolton for many, many years, and it's taken this, you know, it's taken this for us to have this discussion. Mm. I'd say the Times are probably better than most in that they send me to a game every Saturday in the Football League. Most newspapers don't do that. I mean, The Guardian, David Conn is peerless in this. He investigates these sorts of things on a regular basis. But do you think that we have any sort of responsibility in the way that this has been is covered?
We certainly should highlight any whenever there's a problem. I guess the one thing is there's been complacency, really, because so often over the years, clubs have seemingly been in terrible trouble, but they've survived. However, they've done that, and so it almost sounds like crying wolf. You know, you hear there's a club in trouble, you think, yeah, oh, they'll be fine. Somebody will come along at 5 to midnight, and it'll be okay. You know, when ITV Digital collapsed in 2002, the Football League's clubs' income stream from TV suddenly disappeared, and so many people said, well, a third of Football League clubs are at risk of closing. Now, you know, this is widely held opinion, but it didn't happen. They sort of got by somehow. There's such the will to keep the clubs going. It's such that it just doesn't, you know, there's always something. But yeah. Yeah. I guess the danger is once one happens, and if it's sort of, if people think, oh, well, Bury have gone, and then another couple, Macclesfield or Oldham or something, then it becomes the norm, then, you know, it could quickly, be like a pack of cards all full.
Rebecca, you've touched upon already the sort of the fact that football's about supporters going to watch a game. How important is it for football clubs to sort of engage and involve their supporters and sort of have a bit more transparency really in these situations?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's really important. I'm not sure if that's suddenly going to change. I think even just, you know, everything Bill was saying just now, how much needs to happen before we actually make proper sweeping systematic changes. I don't know that there's going to be any, but, you know, you saw it, the scenes on TV of all the Bury fans. They couldn't have done any more than they did, but they were left in the dark for so long. Even, you know, I had friends who were there reporting on the ground who were essentially, you know, really popular with the fans because the journalists were relaying half the information. Yeah. That should not be the case. You know, this is a community club that's incredibly important to the local people, and they've been left in the dark. And, you know, I think it was actually in Matt's piece that he said so much of this, you know, supporters have been saying this for years. Supporters have been raising these kind of concerns and have just been ignored. And so it's not just, you know, the clubs don't need to just be transparent for the benefit of the fans. They could benefit a huge amount from just hearing them out. You know, these people have followed that club for, you know, 40, 50 years, some of them. They would have a lot of insight into what's going wrong, what they see as problems. But you've got management and ownership that just aren't listening at all.
Matt, we're hearing about lots of, you know, there's lots of conversations about this now, about perhaps the pyramid can't sustain 72 professional clubs, talking about B teams, you know, regionalised leagues. There seems to be a lot of talk about everything except, you know, everything seems to be on the table except the discussion about narrowing the gulf between the Premier League and the rest, which really I can't see. While that still exists, I can't see any way that the pyramid is not going to continue to crumble like this.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's certainly part, again, a sort of key part of that discussion, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, if you were the Tsar of English football and you had the power to sort of recast everything, you know, you wouldn't start here, would you? I mean, you know, that sort of absolutely critical decision around 91-92 to set up the Premier League, and the FA sort of basically sort of washing its hands of the whole issue was fundamental. I mean, it's, you know, we can look at the Premier League and all its success and, you know, admire it, but you know, as you say, the gulf, you would not create that gulf willfully. No. And that was the sort of absolute fork in the road moment where that started. And it, you know, say if you were a god of English football for the day, you'd do something about it. Now, without that power, I mean, how you get the clubs, you know, the Premier League, I can assure you, were quick on the phone in the last sort of day or two just to sort of say that they're, you know, point out what their parachute funding is and how much they give down to lower leagues and how much more that is than, you know, in comparable countries. Yeah. But it's creating, you know, the Championship, where I watch a lot of football, is, as you all know very well, is a sort of madcap league, because it now has sort of, you know, clubs plummeting down who have sort of armed with that parachute money, and some go into death spirals, and others, you know, are equipped to bounce back because they have, you know, three or four times the turnovers of others that are coming up from League One. And there's a sort of frenetic chaos about it, which encapsulates the problem. But I don't, again, you're asking me how's that going to change, how's it going to improve? I'm scratching my head because, you know, the Premier League clubs in their own sort of desperation are not about to get more generous, if generous is the word. So yes, if you're asking me how it's going to be fixed,
no, it's not.
I'm probably about to jump out the window, because it's not. We can all sit there and say this is what we'd love to happen, but enforcing it, given all the this different tensions and pressures, is blinking hard.
I interviewed the Stevenage owner, Phil Wallace, a couple of weeks ago, and he kind of laid it out in black and white how difficult it is for clubs in the lower leagues. He said he's basically exhausted all income revenues, and this is a guy who has thought outside the box. He's raised kind of capital with share offerings and a bond to redevelop a stand at the ground, and he just said there's nothing else I can do to raise crowds, to increase my incomings, and if I pay any less to players, I go backwards and I fall out the league and you lose £1 million of funding. So that's the sort of tension that we have here. There's no, and that is from the Premier League really, because everyone is trying to shoot for the moon to compete or to progress or even to stand still. It's not there doesn't really seem to be any straightforward solution to any of this at all.
Well, it's amazing how pervasive the idea of just this kind of trickle down money is. I think we still just kind of we rely quite heavily on this narrative that the money in the Premier League somehow finds its way down eventually. We know that doesn't happen in any walk of life really. And I've been quite surprised in the general coverage. The Premier League, I think, have got off, you know, reasonably scot-free.
I agree. Everything seems to be on the table except tackling the perverse inequality essentially between the top league and the rest of us. And I mean, we don't want to get too deep, but it kind of mirrors. We're talking about left behind football clubs and left behind towns. I visit them most weekends, and it's striking that, like, this, and especially in the current sort of political landscape, that this is happening in these towns. And some people have sort of poo-pooed the idea that this is a northern towns thing as well, but it's certainly happening less to clubs around the London area. So I think really that's the first place that we need to discuss above any other.
And some of the checks can be harder on Premier League clubs, which seems absurd given that, you know, the money you need to buy a Premier League club, you've got that money, you know, generally speaking. A lot of these, you know, these owners come with significant portfolios to the table. If you're you know, it seems much easier to buy an EFL club, and it absolutely shouldn't be, because they're the ones that you can run into the ground much faster, and they're the ones with probably much more serious consequences on local communities who rely very heavily on, you know, just the basic quotes in the papers today, like, what am I going to do on a Saturday? Where am I going to take, you know, my son? You said, you know, supporters saying, well, my dad was buried. These kind of things, like, this means so much to these people, and, you know, I just think owners have no idea.
Matt, last one. Henry Winter wrote a sort of bit of a blueprint in the paper today as well. The first point of call for him is the owners and directors test. If there was one thing that you have to start with to try and sort of have any influence and effect in making sure this doesn't happen again, what would it be for you?
Well, I suspect, you know, I mean, the proof of funds, I go back to that point I made. I mean, I think in the real world, I don't think the idea of a sort of protected bond for 3 years of money is going to stack up, because, as I say, they'll be terrified it's going to scare off what sort of buyers they do have. But I think the fact that someone took, you know, that they had a rule that isn't even enforced. I mean, that's how sort of sad it was with the Bury situation, is that, you know, someone bought a club sort of, you know, before they'd even sort of woken up to it, and they weren't going to retrospectively say, oh, you failed this rule, you know, sorry, you can't. I mean, the deal was done, the paperwork was signed. But I guess I'd start there. The idea that you have rules that aren't actually sort of actively enforced shows what a pickle we're in.
Okay, thanks for that, Matt.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching.
There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
While Bury were being expelled, the Premier League wheels kept on spinning and Alexis Sanchez is on his way to Inter Milan after earning more than £11,000 per minute played at Manchester United. United will be paying around £5.4 million towards the salary of a player they are sending on loan, which is about twice the figure it would have taken to rescue Bury. Bill, does this highlight pretty much everything that's wrong with the modern game, or is that too simplistic?
Well, I guess when he came to Manchester United, he was at the very top of the football tree, pretty much the top. He was by far Arsenal's best player, and Manchester City wanted him. He could have almost taken his pick on any club. So the players at the very top will get absolute fortunes because there's so much interest in football around the world. People willing to pay money to watch, to buy merchandise, to buy sponsors goods, in theory, to buy TV subscriptions. It all goes to the very top. So there's this an absolute gulf inevitably between the very top and the likes of Bury at the bottom. But as I say, in theory, Sanchez would be worth this if he was playing at his best for Manchester United and winning them trophies. But of course, he's offered practically zero. I mean, it would have been better to put somebody in from the youth team, as it turns out. I mean, that's not to say it's hard really to say, well, that definitely shows he's a lazy so-and-so and how can he suddenly become so bad. I mean, obviously he's had lots of injuries. That's going to be that's a huge frustration. Then you take time to get back up to speed, and then he wasn't playing regularly, and his manager, Jose Mourinho, was slagging him off in public. And who knows, he may have had other personal problems. I don't know. There's a lot to consider, and it's hard to know. However, what you can say is that, yes, it's extraordinary how much money Manchester United paid for almost nothing.
Rebecca, I mean, it's hard to forget that he was one of the best players in the Premier League when he joined Manchester United. Do you think sometimes we are too quick? I think Bill suggested that he has had some sort of personal problems and injuries. Do you think we're sometimes a bit too quick to forget about the human aspect of these guys? They're not just sort of rich mercenaries. They actually have issues in their lives as well, and it's not always straightforward.
Yeah, maybe.
No, that's a no then.
I've not got buckets of sympathy, I have to admit. Okay. I think if I was getting, what was it, 6.5 million a goal, or my favourite one, which was 400 grand a dribble, then just this graphic in the Times today, then yeah, I would, I don't know. No, I think we're quick to forget maybe the nuances and sort of the path that brought him. You know, he didn't just wake up one day and decide to be grumpy and then it all went downhill. I think one of the interesting things that I've seen that's kind of cropped back up this week are these stories that we saw about actually warnings from Arsenal. Like they did mention, you know, he is a bit of a lone wolf. He's a bit of a sort of sullen guy. He's not necessarily a team player. He's a bit sort of a guy who maybe wants the game to be about him. They mentioned this. This was all, you know, it wasn't completely unknown. It wasn't...
They were almost virtues in the way he played at Arsenal, and
exactly.
Now he's kind of completely gone full circle.
Exactly. And I saw a piece today, actually, which was like, you know, oh, Sanchez is best when he's smiling. You've got to keep the playful. Like, okay, yes, true, but I think what you've literally got is a case of managers who are willing to pander to that and managers who aren't. And yes, okay, that's it. You know, everyone has their own sort of stance on what they want from a player and whether you should pander to a particularly individualistic, highly sort of stylized player who wants to, you know, come off the pitch and know that that game was about them. But obviously he's not, well, I would say this suggests he's not massively adaptable. And when things didn't start to go his way, or there wasn't a manager who was happy to let him smile all day and you know, and take the limelight, then those things change. But these aren't, you know, completely new things. We saw this, you know, elements of this in his play before, but, or like you said, what was once a virtue has kind of made his, you know, essentially made a terribly miserable spell for him.
Given that Manchester United aren't exactly blessed with attacking options right now, and they've let Lukaku go, was this a wise move on their part? Should they have tried to rehabilitate him, get him back in the team and happy, is whether that's that,
well,
what Ollie wants to do.
Might have been, that might have been too difficult, but I mean, you could say they, where United went wrong is not buying a striker in the summer, especially as they let Lukaku go as well. I know Lukaku doesn't look like he's a title winning standard player either, but
and this is about 100 million plus worth of, yeah, footballers.
So I mean, in themselves, letting those two go based on their performances was fine, but you needed to replace them, really. You've got Rashford, who often plays on the left, and you could argue slightly better on the left, but Martial, again, plays on the left as well sometimes. And after those two, there's Mason Greenwood, who's only 17, and you can't really be relying on him to score 15 or 20 goals this season. So yeah, United are, for a team in the, among the big six, to have, they're very short on numbers in for strikers, really, forwards stroke strikers. So, you know, as I said, letting Sanchez go in itself was okay, but I mean, you need somebody else to replace him, and they didn't do that.
It was reported in the paper yesterday that there's been quite a spike in the number of English players playing in the Premier League. Is that the only silver lining, that players like Rashford and Mason Greenwood are, well, they're going to have to get some more opportunities, really, or are we kind of looking at straws there?
I think it's always got to be a silver lining, right? Young players, English players as well, getting opportunities, it's great. I mean, that's what we want to see. I think that's what fans want to see. And you hope, I think, because the current England setup, I would suggest, does quite well at nurturing young talent. You'd hope that works really well, kind of in tandem, in conversation with one another. But as Bill said, they can't be relied upon. And I think the pressure that then puts on, you know, essentially a teenager's shoulders, it's not natural, and it's not necessarily how these clubs should be operating. So, yes, silver lining, but long term, great idea, probably not. Yeah. So yeah, I think we need to. A lot needs to be looked at in coming months about, you know, what that will look like.
Okay, well, the biggest game of the Premier League weekend is the North London derby between Arsenal and Tottenham at the Emirates on Sunday. Spurs were beaten at home by Newcastle last weekend. Henry Winter wrote this week about the need for the old Mauricio Pochettino to come back. Bill, what's up with the Spurs coach? I think Paul Joyce last episode compared him to Jose Mourinho.
Yeah.
A little bit something. Moody at the moment.
Yes, very grumpy. I think he's probably, he may be just getting a touch disillusioned with how things are going in his spell at Spurs. He joined in 2014, and then by 2016 he got to the stage where they had a really decent chance of winning the league, partly because the other big teams were having off seasons, but they messed up, and Leicester won in and won the title comfortably in the end. So 2 years ago, it was looking really promising for Pochettino. He would have been confident of winning the title with Tottenham in another couple of years. He had Real Madrid and Manchester United. He would have thought being quite keen on him in the coming years, but now it's not looking so promising. I mean, he's done brilliantly, you have to say, and he's turned Tottenham into a force in Europe. Champions League, they got to the final last season. They were very unlucky the season before to lose to Juventus. I mean, they've had a series of really good, strong performances against the top teams in Europe. So he's done fantastically, but he just get the feeling he thinks, no, we're not going to win the title, are we? I'm never going to win the title with Tottenham. He needs to, and his reputation might be dipping a bit. And it's quite natural if you'll start to moan a bit.
Much of the issues seem to be centred around transfers or potential transfers before the end of the window. And Daniel Levy's always been praised for his prudent running of the club, but it seems to be having a bit of a disruptive effect on players when you're on the squad, when you're kind of counting down the days to transfer deadline day, and four or five of your players are sort of agitating for a move or unhappy about not getting contract offers and things like that. So it's kind of putting a serious pressure on Pochettino and the squad itself.
It is. Puts a dampener on. He doesn't know the likes of Alderweireld and Eriksen seem like they're keen to go, and Danny Rose has been unsettled for a while, so you don't know whether to just leave the players out and try and think for the future and sort of really weaken your team by leaving out the likes of Eriksen or bring them in, and you're not sure you've got players who are really kind of 100% focused. So yeah, that's an extra issue for him as well. So all sort of, it does make sense that he's not as cheerful as he once was.
Rebecca, do you think that there's a danger of the manager sort of negative vibes transmitting to the squad?
Absolutely. I think we've all seen enough of Jose Mourinho in the past to know that it's a possible sort of transfer. I think also for me, if you look at managers who are sort of the opposite, very upbeat, and clearly loving their job, I'm thinking often Klopp, Phil Neville over the summer when I was out in the World Cup in France, it's very similar.
Pochettino usually,
yeah, the old
I mean, you saw him after the winning against Ajax, so you're not going to see much more emotion than a manager than that.
And if you see how powerful that can be, like, it's a natural conclusion to see how powerful the opposite can be. And I think particularly in this scenario, there's no, you know, the players are probably quite baffled, you know, that, and that I think is very dangerous, because that starts to undermine their confidence in the club, in the management, in all of these things. And if they don't quite understand why something's happened, or they can't see clear reasons, you know, if this grand Pochettino, you know, he's sort of grandly disillusioned, that's a wonderful sort of philosophical thing to be, but if there's no sort of clear reason they can see for it, that's going to make them a little bit jumpy, a little bit unnerved, a little bit unsure about his situation, their situation. I just don't think it's a great atmosphere, and I think it's an atmosphere that could quite quickly have quite serious impact, basically. You know, it doesn't take much for that to spiral and become a sort of club-wide problem.
So do you think that it's a matter of time before he moves on, or... I mean, there's been interest, certainly reported interest in the past. That seems to have quietened down a little bit, because the clubs in question, Real Madrid and Manchester United, have managers. Although we'll see how the seasons develop, but both of those.
Don't speak too soon.
But do we think that if one of those jobs was to become available again, he might decide to jump ship this time?
He might do, but as you say, whether another job does come up remains to be seen. I don't think Tottenham wouldn't be pushing him out, certainly. But he's been there five, this is his sixth season now, so it's, you know, it's quite a long time. He might be looking for a new scenery quite soon. I mean, Klopp has talked about leaving Liverpool in 2022 after 7 years, you know, he thinks that's a kind of a natural length of time, and he'll probably need a rest then, and which is, he also had 7 years at Mainz and 7 years at Dortmund. Maybe Poch will decide to go, but yeah, at the moment he's, especially perhaps the more he moans, it doesn't do him his image any good, I have to say.
Okay, it's the final weekend of games before the international break, so just wanted to ask who or what has impressed you most so far this season. Rebecca, I'll come to you first.
Been
of all,
quite impressed by Liverpool. I just think they're quite enjoyable to watch at the moment. I think also in light of all this talk about, you know, Klopp saying maybe sabbatical on the horizon, I think some, you know, stuff like that then suddenly makes you realise what a manager brings to the game and to the coverage, and it makes our jobs, you know, interesting. So I think, yeah, it's sort of, I think he would be missed were he to take that sabbatical. And I enjoyed, I caught glimpses of the game last night. I was sat next to someone at a dinner party who was watching it on their phone. But I thought that was just an impressive game. And I thought Iwobi in particular was just really just
so sharp, Lincoln
nice
Everton,
to
yeah.
watch. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, so I enjoyed watching him, actually. I thought he really came through.
Bill?
I quite like the fact that in the Premier League so far, that only Watford have had a really poor start. Every team has won, aside from Wolves, I think, who've got three draws. So what you really don't want is two or three teams just dropping far adrift. So it's nice to see the Sheffield United, Villa and Norwich all getting a first one, and particularly Norwich, the style of play they've shown is real breath of fresh air, fantastic to watch.
Yeah, I was going to say that as well. I think that the three promoted teams this year all have a kind of identity and a style of play that they've not been promoted and thought we're going to have to suddenly turn defensive. You know, they've stuck with that, and I wouldn't be surprised if the three of them stayed up. In fact, I mean, I think Norwich might have issues defensively, but I think they score enough goals to certainly be competitive. And Sheffield United, I think their home form could see them over the line, and I think the same could be the same of Aston Villa. We saw the sort of raucous scenes after their victory against Everton, and the whole end was vibrating.
Yeah.
So these are really difficult places to go, and I think that's been really, really impressive so far. And also, as I mentioned, the sort of number of young English talent at some of the biggest clubs. Arsenal have people like Joe Willock and Ashley Maitland-Niles, and at Chelsea, obviously Mason Mount and Tammy Abraham. So not even just at the sort of the clubs out with the top six. Even some of the biggest clubs are turning to young English players, which I think is really encouraging. So finally, who do we think really needs a win this weekend? There's been
Pochettino. Probably might put a smile on his face. Yeah, I mean, that's the game that everyone's watching, I think, and that will have the most impact in the immediate future, I think, in the league. I'm doing Palace Villa on Saturday, so either of them, just as long as I have to write a 0-0 draw, then I'm happy, because that's always my worst nightmare.
I think Solskjaer will be really keen for a win. United, only 4 points from three games. They haven't played too badly, actually. We've been a bit unlucky, and quite a decent level of entertainment, enjoyable to watch. But if they don't win at Southampton on Saturday, then I think it might be get a bit difficult for him to play down the kind of feeling of negativity at which would probably arise around Old Trafford.
Okay, well, be interesting to watch. That's it for now. Many thanks to my guests today, Matt Dickinson, Rebecca Myers and Bill Edgar. Remember, you can subscribe to The Times and The Sunday Times to enjoy award-winning journalism online on your smartphone or tablet. It's just £1 a week for an 8-week trial. Search The Times subscription for more information, and we'll be back on Monday.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.